Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the healthcare they need on the web at chcf.org, and the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org.
It's Tuesday, November 27th, 2018, and this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news and culture magazine. I'm Alice Daniel.
And I'm Monica Velez. It's the week after Thanksgiving, a time to fill up on leftovers, so to speak. Well, on today's show, we're going to look inside our proverbial fridge and pull out some of our favorite stories from this past year. You've heard of Mr. Potato Head. One of our features places him front and center.
But first, we've got a few new items cooked up for you. Let's start with a preview of a recent Fresno tradition, Swede Fest. This Sunday, the Tower Theater will be playing about 20 Sweded films on the big screen. And if you haven't heard of a Sweded film before, it's like a short home remake of a real film, but as low budget as you can get. Think sheets for the background and cardboard cutouts for props. FM 89's Laura Satsui spoke with the event organizers.
Brian Harley and Rocky Rodriguez, you guys are the organizers of Fresno's Swede Fest. First of all, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having us. Yeah.
And just a note, so we're speaking on a Monday with hours to go before the deadline for entries closes, but we are less than a week before the festival. Do you guys know what kind of films roughly you'll be playing this weekend?
We do, yeah. The films tend to come in very last minute. Just the way our Sweeters work. But we do know we've got a couple of good films like The Lion King and Jurassic Park and movies I'm sure you've heard of.
I think those Holes was one of the entries
Holes,
in there.
Yeah.
And so maybe we should back up a little bit and explain. Obviously, you guys aren't actually playing The Lion King or you're not actually playing Holes.
Correct.
But can you explain a little bit for me, what is a Sweeted film?
Well, a Sweeted film is a low-budget, homemade remake of a Hollywood film. So we kind of encourage people to get together with their family and friends, pick their favorite movie, and you kind of get together and remake it, either the whole movie or a scene in like 4 minutes or less, just using stuff you have laying around the house, some creativity, and then you send it to us, and then we play it on the big screen at the Tower Theater.
Wow, so that's a really fun opportunity if maybe you've never done something like that. You can see something homemade on the big screen, as you said.
Yeah. Starring you.
And it's a low pressure. You know, there's no winners or losers. We just ask people to think about their favorite movie and get creative and have some fun.
And how low budget are we talking? That's what the description used, Rocky. Is this like just flashlights or the cheapest lights you can use? Or
yeah, I mean, the low budget is just, we encourage just to use stuff you have laying around the house. You don't actually have to go and purchase anything, you know. But like when you need to build a spaceship, so you just can make stuff out of cardboard, which is what we do most of the time. Is just like, what can we make out of cardboard?
Use your couch cushions, you know.
Yeah, build a fort.
Yeah.
So we kind of just use creativity over going out and buying stuff, and just kind of, you know, take these big Hollywood budget movies that, you know, cost millions of dollars and just make it in your living room using stuff you have laying around. And it's all about the thought process of putting it together.
And does this happen in other places, or is Fresno the only Swede Fest, you know, hub?
Well, it's kind of all based around a movie that came out in 2008 called Be Kind, Rewind. That's where the term Sweded film comes from. And that a few months after that film came out is when kind of held the first Swede Fest here in Fresno. Mm-hmm. It was nowhere else at the time. But has since then, you know, we did it twice a year for many years. And eventually we had a few Swede Fests pop up in other areas. There's two in Florida. There's a Palm Beach Swede Fest and a Tampa Bay Swede Fest. And there's kind of been one-off Swede Fests in other towns. In Pittsburgh,
right?
In New Hampshire, in Scotland.
Yeah.
That brings up a really good question. Where maybe have people outside of Fresno been like pitching you Swede Fest films, even though they're not here?
Yeah, absolutely. We've gone, after one of our videos kind of went and blew up on the internet, we started getting a lot of entries from outside of the country. So we've gotten entries as far away as from like Romania, the Philippines, Australia, that were sending us their films here to Fresno at the Sweet Fest. So it was kind of awesome. You know, the power of the internet kind of just brings, and the love of film just got, you know, brings everyone together.
Wow. I want to play a clip from one of the films you guys made last year. It's from a very well-known science fiction franchise. So let's take a quick listen.
I need someone to show me my place in all this.
So if you caught the melody in there, that was from a Swedish version of a trailer for Star Wars: The Last Jedi, which I think you guys made for last year's fest, right?
We did, yes.
Can you break that trailer down for me? How did you guys, obviously you can hear the melody, you can hear people talking, saying lines from the film, but it sounds like it's a cappella, it sounds like it's voice. How did you create that?
Actually, the sound is all done by one person. So our buddy Hawk kind of just takes that role. He took on the audio role. He loves to do this stuff. So he, from what he's told me his process, he just sits in his in front of his laptop and times like in his car while he's running errands, and he'll just start recording and start listening to the audio and then just kind of start recording little bits of it and then just layering it over and over again. He's an audiophile, so that's what he loves to do. So yeah, and then at that point, when the audio's done, then we bring in the visuals and kind of sync them up, and it all kind of works out.
When we say it's homemade, we really mean every part of it's homemade.
Absolutely.
Even down to the music and sound effects.
So were you guys starring in that particular trailer?
I played Luke Skywalker, yes.
Yeah, no, Brian was the star of that one. I did not show up.
You were just behind the camera.
I was behind the camera,
you might
yes.
have had a cameo in there somewhere yeah. in the background.
We like to stay maybe. On the other side of the camera.
Gotcha. Well, can I ask, what do you guys have in the works for this year's film festival? Are you sharing that?
Oh, yeah, we can share that, right?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
We're working on the Captain Marvel trailer. So the Marvel movies are, you know, kind of always been nice or good to us. So we're big fans, and we're doing the Captain Marvel trailer that will be premiering at Sweet Fest.
What has been the most interesting or surprising part of taking on this event and, I suppose, even getting into this hobby?
Well, it's just, like we talked before, it's always interesting to see how, you know, film can kind of go across, you know, so many lines. Like, we encounter people from all across the world, and everyone's passion for film kind of just brings us together. Like, for example, the Romanian entries that we got in, they did not speak a word of English, but their films were English films, and they just mouthed the words, and they just synced it up with the English language. But they didn't know a single word of English. So it's kind of awesome to, like, you know, just the power of, like, to bring people together and just kind of, like, you know, the film itself is just so such an awesome medium.
Yeah, and our audience here in Fresno watching that on the big screen, unless we told them, would have no idea that that came from Romania.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
And also, some of your films have gone viral. Was that a surprise, or what did that feel like the first time it happened?
Yeah, the first time that happened for us was back in 2011 when we did a Swedish version of the Avengers trailer, Marvel Avengers.
Yeah.
And yeah, it did kind of come as a surprise. I mean, we thought this might be a fun thing to do, and we put it out there, and maybe it would help kind of promote Swedfest here locally. And we ended up on Morning Edition on NPR a few weeks later. So it was kind of nuts. Yeah, yeah. We certainly weren't expecting it.
For people wanting to get involved, maybe not this year since the deadline's going to close tonight, but for next year, do you have any really good tips or guidelines for how to think about making these films?
We just kind of tell people that, like, you know, think about your favorite movie and also look at your friends, look at your family and be like, man, this guy kind of looks like he'd be a good Brad Pitt. Or she looks like she'd be a good, like, Julia Roberts. What can we do and, like, work around? And, like, what's a good, like, film that this person can star in? And then just kind of build off of that. You know, it could be as simple as that. It could be as, like, you know, I want to build a spaceship. So what films have a spaceship? I want to make something out of cardboard. So you kind of start with those kind of little seeds and have them grow from there. And it's 4 minutes or less, so you really don't have to, you know, it doesn't take too much time. It doesn't have to. It can. But, you know, it's totally how much you want to put into it. You know, and that's kind of where you go from. You never know where it's going to lead you.
And we like to say there's no wrong way to Swede. So, you know, I think the traditional way is you summarize the whole movie in, you know, under 4 minutes. But you can pick your favorite scene in the movie. You can do the trailer. you know, it's really up to you how you want to interpret the film and remake it.
Very cool. We've been speaking with Brian Harley and Rocky Rodriguez. They are the organizers for Fresno's Swede Fest, which is taking place this Sunday, December 2nd at the Tower Theater. It's a free event. You can find more information at swedefest.com. And they'll be playing homemade Sweded films, and it's bound to be an interesting time. Brian and Rocky, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much.
When you think of Instagram celebrities, the Kardashians and performers like Beyonce probably come to mind. But with the Instagram handle Physics Fun, one of Fresno's own physicists recently hit 1 million followers. He has almost as many as the astronaut Scott Kelly, and even more than celebrity astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson. Fresno State physics professor Ray Hall will be giving a talk about his work in Fresno next week. And he spoke with FM89's Carrie Klein about how he built a massive Instagram following around videos of curious physics toys.
When I was a grad student of many, many decades ago, I stumbled across a kite store that sold some toys that I realized exhibited physics principles that I could use in the classroom. One was something called a clacker, two little balls that snap together and look like they're trading places when you swing them around. Another one was a little styrofoam ball on the end of a pipe, and you would blow through it and the styrofoam ball would hover. And I realized, oh, these toys have great potential to connect to my students to show surprising behavior. So over the intervening 30 years, I've amassed a collection of these items. And so the Instagram page is really me showcasing kind of my personal collection of what I call physics toys. And like, for instance, my average post gets about 20,000 likes and often 500,000 views. So it's an interesting formula that just seems to be working. And I don't exactly know why it's working, but I'm happy that it is.
Yeah, I mean, they're really cool videos. I mean, you see, scrolling through them, you see things about viscosity. I mean, you touch upon not just physics, there's also chemistry, there's math, but there's mechanics, and there's magnets, and there's liquids and colors and, you know, light refraction, things like that. You know, what kind of a collection have you been amassing? I mean, how many of these do you have?
Well, yeah, I have like about 800 objects, really. And they're all kind of amassed in cabinets. And you know, anytime you're a collector, I think you have this idea, well, what does my collection mean? Maybe it'll be so amazing that it will be housed in a museum or something and people will come to look at it. But I realized that's probably not very practical. And I have actually a larger audience of the world using social media. So I feel like my Instagram posts are kind of my version of a museum that has been shared with over, well, millions and millions of people from around the globe have seen my museum. So I'm kind of thinking I'm putting my museum online.
Yeah, and as you said, you know, millions and millions of people have seen your videos, and you have, you know, in terms of followers, you have over 1 million followers. I mean, you're basically Instagram famous.
Instagram famous. It's a strange term. Actually, that's what my stepdaughters tell me. It is interesting. I've been invited a few places to give talks because of this Instagram thing. I was just out at a conference in Alabama called ThinkerCon that was put on by some famous YouTubers, but it was this congregation of fellow content providers that are focusing on education. And it was just a wonderful event. And I got to meet people that are actually been following me for a long time and wanted to meet me. So yeah, it's a strange kind of fame that I'll take it. It's kind of fun. It's like-minded people and getting people excited about science.
Yeah, I'm interested in that and how in your relationship with social media and your relationship with Instagram, because I can imagine there being a lot of academics out there who might kind of begrudge it, who, you know, they can say, well, I got to this point in my career without social media. I was able to develop this myself. Are you excited to be involving this, you know, this in your career? Or, you know, is there a part of you that's like, oh man, this is a little bit of a ball and chain. It's difficult to maintain this.
Well, a little bit of both, but mostly it's just been fun. I'm no longer doing research. I've decided that part, at least physics, hardcore physics research, I did that for 17 years, and I knew I always wanted to have a career in teaching, and it's kind of my pleasure is conveying physics concepts in a way that people can understand it, whether it be an undergraduate engineering major, one of our graduate physics majors, or just the general public. I just get a real rush when I can see that people are understanding something they hadn't understood before.
Did you ever think that your Instagram feed would be this popular? Did you ever think you'd have this many followers?
It's been a little surprising, actually. With no bikini pictures and no Kardashians, I've got a million followers that want to see a little dose of science every day. And I don't think that's really represented that much on Instagram. So when I first started posting, I had maybe 2,000 followers. I thought that was pretty good. And it seemed like the first few posts I was just putting out there just to test the waters. And I was really surprised to wake up one day and have 10,000 followers. And then something happened, something went viral on Reddit, and I woke up to find that I had 200,000 followers. And so that's when I decided to post on a daily basis. I can't create new content all the time, so I'd say at least 7 days a week, 3 of those days will be new content, and the others will be stuff that maybe I showed a year ago, or I slightly shot from a different angle, and people don't seem to mind, and it just keeps growing. I'm humbled and surprised and delighted.
So do you feel like this presence you've developed on Instagram, has that informed your own teaching in any way?
Oh, a little bit. I think, though, that what I do on Instagram is a little bit different than what I do in my teaching. My Instagram is mostly just to get people to have that gestalt kind of wow moment and to have them have a positive feeling about what science and physics is. A lot of the comments are, I didn't know that was physics, right? And so just to open people's eyes and say, yeah, this is all. If you want to understand the world. Matter of fact, one of the taglines on my Instagram is, physics is the real magic of the universe. And I think that maybe that comes across in many of the videos where it's something that you just didn't expect was going to happen, and you find out the universe doesn't exactly behave like you thought it did.
So why don't you show me a couple examples?
Well, here's one that I posted a couple days ago. It's called Euler's disk. It's a famous phenomena of basically how a quarter, when it's rolling on a desktop, can have this interesting both rolling and spinning motion, or what we call sprolling. This one, however, is about much larger than a half dollar. It's about a centimeter thick, and it's quite heavy, so it takes an awful long time for it to finally settle down and come to rest with the desktop.
It's big and sparkly. It looks almost like a hockey puck, a little bit smaller, but very heavy, much heavier than that. And you're rolling it on a mirror. Wow, so cool. I mean, it was like, yeah, like you'd imagine spinning a quarter on a desk and it just kind of does its little wobbly thing and then eventually just kind of settles, but it took much longer to get there than a quarter would.
So this is much more massive, so it has more inertia, and actually they've done measurements and the point of contact with the mirror gets over 200 miles an hour right before it comes into contact with the mirror and stops. So it's kind of a fun toy.
Very cool. Okay, so you got another one here, a wand-looking thing here. Tell me what this one is.
Well, people have heard of rain sticks. They're usually made out of bamboo, and they have seeds in them. This one's made out of plexiglass with little metal beads. And in essence, it's interesting that this particular thing will generate what's called white noise. And so sources of white noise are interesting, and this is just one that can be used in the laboratory to kind of study what produces white noise. White noise is characterized by all frequencies having roughly the same amplitude, and it makes that kind of famous shushing sound. And so this is kind of like a high-tech rain stick.
It's clear, and it's full of tiny, tiny little metal pellets, almost, that fall through this little set of stairs and holes. And so any one of these little pellets, you know, is not creating white noise on its own, but all together, they all are.
That's correct. It's more of an emergent phenomena, and it's one I haven't studied that thoroughly, but when I was researching it, because I always like to do a little research before I post my Instagram post, I found out that white noise comes in different flavors, gray noise, pink noise, depending on the slight variations in the distribution, and I think this one lends itself to a little more of pink noise, is what I understand.
Pink. Okay, I'll think of that next time I hear a rain stick. So next Monday, you're going to be speaking at Café Scientifique. It's an event in central Fresno where scientists speak about their work to the public in a restaurant in a very public setting. What are you going to be talking about?
Well, in this case, I'm not going to be talking about my research. I've actually spoken at Café Scientifique a few times on many of my research interests, including the philosophy of science and how we know how science works. But this time, I'm just going to be doing an expose on kind of the success I've had on Instagram. And so I'm going to talk a little bit more about how I came to start posting on Instagram, kind of how I built the following, a few of the things that have happened to me, a few famous people that have liked my post and have gotten in contact with me. And also I'm gonna bring a few of my favorite physics toys and show them there live and talk about a little bit about the physics and the history of these devices.
Very cool. Okay, well, Ray Hall, a physics professor at Fresno State, thanks so much for talking with me.
Well, thank you for having me.
Ray Hall will be speaking Monday, December 3rd at Café Scientifique, a monthly science talk held at Santa Fe, Basque, in central Fresno.
So now, let's turn to some of our favorite past stories. Back in July, FM 89's Laura Satsui introduced us to a Fresno mom who was homeless and pregnant while her kids lived with family. Here's Laura's story about how she got off the streets and why housing families can be a complicated matter.
At first, I was like, oh my God, this is such a bad area, but I'm like, I need to get in somewhere. But now, like, we're here, it's great. Like, I feel really comfortable. Like, everybody, like, looks out for each other, and it's nothing like where I was before, and just always watching out and watching your back. It's not like that here.
Christina Montalvo shares an apartment in southeast Fresno with her boyfriend, their baby daughter, and her son. They've lived there for nearly a year, a milestone she's proud of because where she was before was homeless.
And I was pregnant on the streets, so then I kind of just felt like I had nowhere to go, and I didn't know about any programs or anything.
Montalvo was addicted to methamphetamines at the time. Her three other children were staying with family members, and she visited them as often as possible. But she says she was really caught up in her addiction.
Just everyday thing, and then I started selling drugs, and it was just like, I just felt like I couldn't stop. Like, even if I wanted to, I just couldn't. And I did want to. I remember just being in the streets, just like sitting there with my boyfriend, like, what's gonna make me stop? Like, I don't wanna do this no more, I don't.
Montalvo had heard about Fresno County's emergency housing program, and with a baby on the way, she was determined to get in. She had been sanctioned from welfare before becoming homeless, and she had to clear that first. The day she did was the day she went into labor.
I was like, I can't believe it. Like, no, like, this is, I'm looking online for things like to stop contractions, or I'm like, maybe it's just Braxton Hicks. But I knew, because I've had three other kids, so I knew what was going on.
It was in the hospital after having her baby that Montalvo enrolled in a program to get clean and start putting her life back together. Today, the 32-year-old just finished summer school courses at Fresno City College. She's hoping to transfer to Fresno State soon to finish her degree in business management. Montalvo is one of thousands of families in the county getting help from the Fresno Housing Authority. She offsets the cost of her rent with a housing voucher. Preston Prince is the authority's CEO.
We think that for every family that we're able to help, there's probably three or four that are economically or income-wise are qualified, but we just don't have the resources to help them.
Prince says there isn't a one-size-fits-all approach for housing people or even for addressing homelessness. The Housing Authority partners with other service providers to help their residents get social services along with housing. The approach they use is often called housing first. They try to get people into a place as quickly as they can. But Prince says that does not mean housing only.
We're starting to really focus on wellness, which is a little bit harder to define, but that's what we're really looking for. It isn't just necessarily that someone's in a house, which is great, but that they are connected, right? That they have social connections and human connections and employment opportunities and educational opportunities, and that they have wellness within their lives.
Often, families start their search for resources, including housing, at the Paparello House. Sarah Mirhadi is the chief programs officer there. She says the number of families they assist varies day to day, and it's hard to know exactly how many homeless families are out there. At the same time, assisting families can be different from helping individuals.
It can be a little bit more difficult because a family has multiple issues that are sometimes going along. Also, finding space for them. Homeless individuals sometimes have a little bit easier time finding space. Family shelter here in Fresno is pretty limited for the most part.
This year's homeless point in time count for Madera and Fresno counties says that families only make up 12% of the total homeless population, and that there are less than 100 homeless families overall. In comparison, Fresno Unified School District has documented more than 1,700 homeless children, but many of those families live doubled up with another family. The point-in-time count would consider them to be housed, even if the living situation isn't ideal. But sometimes that approach of staying with another family or family member can be a temporary fix, something homeless assistance groups call diversion. And in the meantime, they continue to work to get their own place.
I would say a lot of our families is diversion and individuals, a lot of people coming in. I mean, that's to properly assess them. Because resources are so limited, we have to make sure that those limited resources, you have to prioritize.
But Mirhadi, like Prince, says that housing homeless families and individuals always takes a multi-layered approach.
Nobody has the answer. Housing first isn't the answer. It's part of many answers. And that's the one thing. And diversion is not the answer. It's part of a process, the whole thing.
For Montalvo, who was homeless just 2 years ago, she's grateful to have made it this far in the process. She's hoping that it won't be long before she can buy her own house. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Laura Satsui.
We caught up with Christina Montalvo last week, just before Thanksgiving, and she says she's doing well. She has a job at an elementary school, and she's almost finished getting her associate's degree in business at Fresno City College. Her plan is still to attend Fresno State next fall.
A few months ago, I reported on a woman whose immigration case was disrupted when former Attorney General Jeff Sessions ruled that domestic and gang violence are no longer grounds to apply for asylum. Because she is among the thousands of asylum seekers whose cases remain in limbo because of that decision, we're running her story again.
Hi, Jeff. So what you have in front of you is a rabbit and currant pot sticker.
The soft chatter in the waiting room at the Yara Law Group offices in Fresno are muffled by a Food Network show playing on TV. Receptionists tap their keyboards and answer phone calls. A woman from El Salvador, who we'll call Anna, is among the dozen people in the room. A receptionist calls her name and she goes in to see her immigration attorney, Jeremy Clayson. He's preparing documents he'll eventually file with the immigration court in San Francisco. She starts to tell her story. When I first got together with my son's father, everything was normal. Time passed and he became aggressive, violent, and there were moments when he would hit me. Valley Public Radio is granting Anna anonymity because her ex-boyfriend, who's also her son's father, doesn't know where they are now. And she says she fears if he discovers where they are, he'll find them and hurt them. She says the abuse began about a year after they started dating. After her son was born, she says the beatings and verbal abuse got even worse. And the people around to witness it, his family, look the other way. They mistreated me. They mistreated my son like we were people who didn't matter. The beatings were frequent. There was even a moment where he hit me with a machete. His family did nothing to defend me. They pretended like I was an animal who was being mistreated. Tears streamed down Anna's cheeks as she tells me her story. Anna says she tried to get help. She says she called the police one night he was beating her while she was pregnant. She says he was let go the next day. Nothing happened. And she says nothing got better. For the next few years, Anna says she was abused daily. She says her ex called her names and would hit her with whatever was in his hand for any reason. He would hit me and I'd get huge bruises. I didn't go out so people wouldn't see and ask me about it. But nearly a year ago, Anna took her son and with the help of a family member, reached the Texas border. Anna says it was her best option because her son's father was never going to stop looking for them. While she was at a detention center in Texas, an asylum officer interviewed her. And according to the documents, the asylum officer found a credible fear finding, citing domestic violence. Clayson recalls the day Anna first came in to see him. He says he remembers telling her she would absolutely win her asylum case. But suddenly, things changed. For the record, Clayson's firm, the Yara Law Group, is a corporate supporter of Valley Public Radio.
So I put in my notes, I'm sorry. So right here, after I recalled her, I called her on June 19th, so June 7th. 12 days later, I call her June 19th, advised client of new Jeff Sessions asylum decision, frowny face, much less chance of win, of success.
On June 11th, Sessions announced citing domestic and gang violence no longer qualifies as an asylum claim. Like Anna, that decision put hundreds of others in the valley and thousands in the nation in limbo.
It's also new. Attorneys across the country are trying to formulate. We're trying to put her into a different box. I'm still trying to formulate that. No one really does quite yet. No one does. We're trying to formulate how we can how we can put her into a social group without saying that the social group is women who are property of their domestic partnerships.
Clayson says his office has dozens of asylum cases around the San Joaquin Valley. He says most of his clients applying for asylum who are from Central America and Mexico were escaping domestic or gang violence. He says the outcome of Ana's and other asylum cases are going to depend on which judge they get.
It matters a lot. It matters a lot, although the vast majority of judges in San Francisco make decisions that are favorable to immigrants in the asylum context.
According to data from TRAC, a nonpartisan and nonprofit data research center, over the years, asylum outcomes have continued to depend on which judge is assigned to the case. They've been compiling data on all asylum outcomes for more than a decade, and their most recent data follows that trend. The San Francisco Immigration Court is where Valley cases are heard, and according to TRAC data compiled from 2012 to 2017, the odds of getting an asylum case denied in San Francisco court ranges from about 9% to 97%, depending on which judge is assigned to the case. TRAC's report also mentions that it's natural for asylum decisions to vary since each case is different.
Individual asylum officers and judges consider individual cases. So it's really mixed. In some cases, you know, there have certainly been some cases denied after the AB decision. But in other cases, judges are still granting and attorneys are tweaking their arguments and submitting additional evidence in order to try and address the ways in which Sessions attempted to change the law.
That's Lindsay Harris. She's an assistant law professor at the University of the District of Columbia. She co-directs their Immigration and Human Rights Clinic and has a focus on asylum cases. She says more asylum cases will probably get denied than before.
One thing that's very certain is it's an absolute increase in attorney resources and time that have to be put into the cases and kind of redoing the cases and submitting new arguments and coming up with new particular social groups and submitting more evidence on country conditions and things.
When the Attorney General announced the asylum policy change, he said the law doesn't protect violent instances based on private or personal matters. And over time, Sessions says the asylum qualifications expanded beyond what Congress originally intended. Officials at the United States Citizenship and Immigration Services declined to do a recorded interview. But in an emailed statement to Valley Public Radio, spokesman Michael Barrs wrote, "The current system is prone to loopholes, fraud, and abuse, and prevents legitimate asylum seekers from being seen in a timely fashion." Back in Clayson's office, Ana stands up and shows me the scar she has on her calf from the machete attack. It's healed now, but the memory is still vivid. She can't know for sure, but Ana says if she stayed in El Salvador, she believes her ex would have killed her. Even though Ana's case will be an uphill battle, Ana and Clayson say they're both hopeful.
These are the cases that keep me up at night, to be honest. It's the cases that I think about over weekends and where you have to go even beyond 100%. Even the cases that you have to, every plausible argument that I can think of and conceive, I have to fight because it truly is a life and death situation.
It could take years until Ana knows what will happen in her asylum case. But she says at least now, she doesn't have to live with the torment of thinking her ex will find her. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Monica Velez. Since my story aired, Attorney General Jeff Sessions resigned, and Matthew G. Whitaker is now the acting Attorney General. As for Ana, her attorney filed an application for a work permit, but even that will take months to be approved. He says he's still hopeful he can win her asylum case.
In our next story, we revisit workplace violence in healthcare. Over the course of 3 months in 2017, over 2,000 incidents were reported in California. That's about one every other week. But some experts say that workplace violence is underreported, in part because tolerating it is just part of the job. In collaboration with USC's Center for Health Journalism, FM89's Laura Satsui reports that this is a perspective many in California hope to change.
6 months ago, Jennifer Bailey worked at an assisted living memory care facility in Fresno. One evening, she was helping a patient get ready for bed.
I was walking toward the door to leave after I got the resident I was assisting in bed, and she, for lack of a better term, came unhinged.
She says the job was similar to being a certified nursing assistant, and she would help residents with day-to-day things. That evening, Bailey was walking out with a bag of dirty laundry, and she says the resident's roommate grabbed the bag, thinking that Bailey was stealing her clothes.
Once the bag broke, she started grabbing more at me, and it felt like it was going on for hours. I was probably there for 25 seconds.
She says it only stopped when the resident Bailey was helping get to bed tried to intervene.
She got up and she's like, "Don't hit her," and starts coming toward her. And when she turned to face the woman who was getting out of bed to come to my rescue, I was able to get my walkie, run in between them to protect themselves from each other. And that's when I was able to scream, I needed help immediately. The nurse came in and, you know, it was diffused at that second, but I was beyond hysterical and my arms were red because I had scratches from my elbow down to my wrist on both arms.
The resident who attacked Bailey was actually moving to a new facility within the week, so Bailey knew that she wouldn't have another encounter with that resident, but the stress and anxiety stuck with her.
For a lot of ways, I kind of felt, well, if I can't do this, you know, they're going to look at it like, you can't do your job. And they'll find somebody else who can.
Bailey hadn't experienced violence on the job before then, but at the time, she was also feeling burnt out. Beyond telling her supervisor, she didn't feel like she had a lot of options to help herself recover. After the attack, Bailey decided to quit.
It was kind of the figurative straw.
Bailey thought if she wanted to stay in that job, she might just have to accept this. Among healthcare workers, she isn't alone in thinking that. Dr. Susan Goodwin-Gerbrick is a professor of environmental health sciences at the University of Minnesota. She came out with one of the first comprehensive studies about violence against nurses back in 2004.
We certainly found very high rates for those that work in nursing homes and long-term care facilities, also the emergency and psychiatric departments.
Gerbrick says that violence can come as both physical and non-physical force against someone. Healthcare workers who reached out to us say they've been threatened, had things thrown at them, and were even punched or kicked when trying to give someone care. Gerbrick's study surveyed over 6,000 nurses in Minnesota and came up with several risk factors. A majority of assaults were from patients. Gerbrick also found that while over half of the assaults were reported, either in writing or orally, many who didn't report said it was because they felt like tolerating violence was part of the job.
It's not just the nurses, but, technically all healthcare personnel are at potential risk.
Gerbrick noted that there is legislation moving through Congress to curb the issue. In March, California Representative Ro Khanna introduced the Healthcare Workplace Violence Prevention Act. At the same time, some states have taken it upon themselves to implement healthcare violence prevention rules. California is one of them, and that's in part due to the California Nurses Association, a state chapter for National Nurses United.
The federal bill is very similar to the California bill. It's a good template. It's successfully passed.
Gerard Brogan is a registered nurse and a lead representative with the association. The California bill to prevent healthcare workplace violence passed in 2014. It required hospitals to develop a workplace violence prevention plan. The plan had to include things like annual employee training and a system for reporting incidents to the state.
Looking at the research, we came to the conclusion that hospitals are loath to report incidents of violence to the state, or anyone for that matter, or collect them themselves.
Hospitals were supposed to have implemented those new regulations as of April of this year, or risk being out of compliance with California's Division of Occupational Safety and Health. It's too early to tell if the new regulation has actually reduced violence. Brogan says that as far as he knows, hospitals have been slow to comply. He also says it's going to take a cultural shift to get nurses and other healthcare employees not to tolerate violence or actions that could escalate.
It's always been seen, the culture really is that it's part of the job. You're here to be a nurse. You're here to self-sacrifice. You've got to suck up patients' complaints, patients' anger, to the point of both verbal and physical abuse.
Local hospitals I spoke with said that they've had safety training and procedures in place long before the new Cal-OSHA regulations. The biggest change, they say, has been the centralized reporting to the state, which they say they've adopted. Jennifer Bailey says she doesn't think her incident was reported outside of the facility because she didn't open a workers' compensation case. On top of that, assisted living facilities aren't included in the new law because the state doesn't classify them as health facilities. But she wishes she had known something like that might happen. She says the training she got didn't cover violence.
No one really says they can lose themselves in a moment. They can get agitated to the point of not realizing how far they've taken it. You know, they just, all they know is they want something or they need something or they're unhappy or they're stressed out or in pain. And a lot of times they can't communicate that.
Bailey says she's moved on, but she still thinks about her old job.
It still makes me sad because I know someone who's coming into the field, they might have the same situation I do. And something has to change. Something needs to be provided.
The catch is knowing what that something should be. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Laura Satsui.
Since this story first aired, Laura reported three more stories on workplace violence in healthcare. You can check them out on our website under the tag Part of the Job. On this Giving Tuesday, we bring you a story about a toy drive, but for parents, specifically parents of preemies. We first ran it a year ago. Here's the story from FM 89 reporter Carrie Klein.
Hi.
Hi.
Whoa.
Whoa.
When Ami Alvarez was born, he weighed just 1 pound. His mother, Ashley Alvarez, had been diagnosed with a life-threatening complication and had to deliver Ami early, at just over 25 weeks.
He was so small and so skinny, and the skin is translucent. You can see, you know, all the veins, and his eyes were still closed.
Ami was a micropreemie, the term for any baby born before 26 weeks of gestation. He spent the first 3 months of his life in the neonatal intensive care unit, or NICU, at Community Regional Medical Center in Fresno. Alvarez and her husband spent practically every day with him, but she still remembers how slowly he seemed to be progressing. She says they felt unable to do anything but wait and hope.
We definitely just took it day by day.
Ami is almost 3 now and a smiley, bubbly little boy. But Alvarez still remembers that early feeling of helplessness. So she's doing something to keep other parents from going through what she did. She takes me to her garage and shows me 3 huge bins.
So I have been collecting potato heads, Mr. and Mrs.
Potato heads, those goofy plastic dolls with detachable limbs and googly eyes. Alvarez has amassed over 100 of them. They're not for micropreemies, but for their parents. They can place the dolls in the incubators next to their babies and take pictures to track their growth. It's a small thing with a big impact.
The thought behind it all is when you get to look back at those weekly pictures, or even just week by week, and you get to see the growth of your preemie every week, it gives the family hope.
She hopes to supply CRMC and Cahuilla Delta Medical Center with enough potato heads for every baby in the NICU on Christmas and for many other high-risk babies throughout the year. She collected over 200 in 2016 through toy drives and is aiming even higher this holiday season. Alvarez wasn't the first to come up with this idea. Last fall, she was searching online for ways to give back to the NICUs that had helped her when she came across the Potato Head Project. It's a nonprofit in Minnesota run by Kristen Moan, a mom of 2 twins born even earlier than Ami was. The seed was planted when the twins were in the NICU in 2013, and Moan's husband bought 2 potato heads on a whim. As she told me during a Skype conversation, their first picture was a social media hit.
Everybody, you know, every week asked when we were going to post the next one and the one after that. So we continuously took photos through the NICU.
After that, a friend with a micropreemie asked Moan for a potato head, then a friend of a friend, and the calls kept coming. She now holds fundraisers to collect the dolls and cover shipping charges. Moan estimates she's donated around 1,000 potato heads to parents in 48 states.
It's such a cheap plastic toy, but
to all these families, it gives them hope, and it gives them the ability to see past where they're at right now.
Ashley Alvarez is not technically affiliated with the nonprofit, but Moan did give her permission to use its name and logo. The Potato Head Project resonates, perhaps, because it's not just about the toy. It's about hope at a time when optimism and certainty are in short supply. Fresno mom Deanna Falls felt that in early 2016. She found the project online and reached out to Moan after delivering her daughter Sabrina at 28 weeks.
They gave me hope that she could be this tiny little size like a Mrs. Potato Head and grow into, you know, a child and a baby.
Tracy Gong is a NICU parent representative at Valley Children's Hospital in Madera, and she too was a micropreemie mom. The hospital doesn't participate specifically in the Potato Head Project, but she says helping parents to see the positives day by day is critical to helping them cope.
Some of our parents are here for months and months and months, our babies are. And if you're sitting here day in and day out, you don't always see those little milestones.
Eyes.
Ashley Alvarez made it through Ami's time in the NICU without a potato head.
Is that his arm?
But now the toy is offering her hope with another milestone.
Shoes.
It's helping Ami learn how to talk. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
This year, Ashley Alvarez is taking a break from her Visalia toy drive. But if you're still interested in donating, she encourages you to look up the Potato Head Project. It's the organization out of Minnesota run by Kristen Moan. You heard from her in the middle of the story.
Changes in immigration policies have not only affected immigrants applying for asylum. President Donald Trump's zero-tolerance immigration policy has also heightened fears of deportations in Valley communities. And that's affected businesses. Last summer, I reported this story on how flea markets are seeing fewer shoppers. Jose Robles scrapes up handfuls of dried chilies into a bag for one of his customers at the Cherry Avenue auction in Fresno County. He's been selling chilies and other vegetables at flea markets in the San Joaquin Valley for 19 years. But business has gone down. He says President Trump's recent immigration policies have affected every vendor.
Toda la gente está asustada por todas esas leyes.
Everyone is scared by all those laws that are happening that the government is getting into. A lot of people are traumatized. A lot of people don't want to leave their homes because they have fears of ICE grabbing and deporting them. A lot of people are scared, and that's been affecting all vendors and all commerces in general. Robles says talk of immigration reform and deportations have Latinos in the Valley on edge, many whom shop at flea markets. He says less people have been going to flea markets since the ramp up in immigration policies. Robles is just one of the many vendors Valley Public Radio spoke to who have seen their businesses suffer since the crackdown on immigration. We're selling a third of what we sold in prior years. That's Lodevina Lopez. She also has a stand at the Cherry Avenue auction. She's been selling clothes, shoes, and toys for 11 years. Lopez says she's seen fewer people coming to flea markets since Trump took office. And recently, it's been worse. But it's not just customers. She says it's the workers, too. Because of all the problems we're experiencing with immigration and all the fear that's been infused in people and they continue to put in people, they don't want to return to work here. Lopez says the fear among workers and customers is consistent in other flea markets she works at. She has stands in Selma, Visalia, and Hanford. But she says people shouldn't be as frightened as they are. It's not a fear we should have. We should keep working like always. But yes, a lot of people get scared. The owner of Cherry Avenue Auction has a different perspective. Neil Burson has owned the market for 17 years with his brother. He didn't agree to a recorded interview, but says the drop in business is not related to immigration issues. Burson says economic factors play a larger role, and so does the weather. Frank Parisi with Sunnyside Swap Meet agrees.
Well, when it rains, no one's going to come out in the rain because they can't put their stuff out in the water. If it gets too hot,
you know, people kind of leave early because of the heat factor, because you're on asphalt, so it, you know, it gets pretty hot out there. So weather is probably one of our biggest factors for the swap meet.
Parisi says he has heard of people being fearful to go to flea markets because of recent immigration policies, but he says it doesn't really affect his swap meet. He says it depends on what area you're in.
You know, there's certain areas like out in the country, you know, there's a lot more of those people that have that type of a situation out there. We don't have that. We have pretty much a little bit better mix of people here. So, but I've heard about that immigration type of thing. We've never had a problem with it here.
But it's the smaller valley towns and rural areas that do depend more on flea markets. Dr. Devra Saxton teaches anthropology at Fresno State. She says flea markets play a vital role in immigrant communities throughout the valley.
Part of it is there aren't a lot of grocery stores or malls in a lot of San Joaquin Valley communities, particularly in the smaller towns and unincorporated communities. But even if you do have access to that, there's something about the remate or the pulga that harkens back to home.
Saxton says many Valley residents come from Mexico, Central America, and Southeast Asian countries, where shopping at open-air markets is a tradition. Whether it be going to socialize or to sell merchandise, she says for Latino immigrants, these markets have a deeply rooted cultural history.
You're able to have conversations with the vendors in your own languages. I mean, there's not just Spanish-speaking vendors, Hmong-speaking vendors. There's also a lot of indigenous-speaking vendors from Oaxaca and Guerrero, and along with those specialty products. So you can have conversations with them that perhaps you can't have in a regular grocery store. So it's not just a commercial space, it's a very social space too.
Flea markets are also critical economic spaces.
Immigrant and low-income entrepreneurs cannot afford retail or storefront space, even in the valley where rents are lower than they are in the Bay Area. And so being able to pay for your booth in the remate or the pulga and to have your hustle, to have your business, and it enables a lot of these families to sustain themselves as well in really critical ways.
Back at the Sunnyside Swap Meet, a Fresno resident says she's here to do just that, socialize and walk around. Norma Lopez zigzags through the aisles of vendors with her grandson. She says he likes coming with her because of the churros. She says lately, and especially since Trump took office, people have been too scared to go out to the flea markets. A lot of people that come to flea markets are undocumented and think ICE is going to come and take them. Like Lopez does, many people come to flea markets for fun and the experience, to take in the smells and tastes of their native countries. Saxton wishes people could think more about what immigrants must go through on a daily basis.
The valley is a very low-income area, and the flea market is where you can go not just to get a good deal, but to kind of be a human and relax and take in the sights and smells and tastes that you enjoy. So it's also, I think, a really critical place of pleasure. And not in under this administration, people are being repressed and terrified, and they can't even have that simple pleasure of going to the remate anymore. That's really disturbing.
With Valley Public Radio, I'm Monica Velez. Since this story first aired, immigration policies have continued to change and tighten, and flea markets are still feeling the impact. But with winter coming, vendors say the weather also plays a role. And that's today's Valley Edition. You can find all of this and more on our website, kvpr.org, or download the podcast. We're on Facebook and Instagram at Valley Public Radio, and on Twitter at KVPR.
Did you know we have an app? It's called KVPR, and it's available for free in app stores on iTunes and Android. The show is produced by me, my co-host Monica Velez, and reporters Laura Satsui and Carrie Klein. Our audio engineer is Marv Allen, and Don Weaver is our production and operations manager. I'm Alice Daniel.
And I'm Monica Velez. This has been Valley Edition. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the healthcare they need, on the web at chcf.org, and the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org.